From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The different ways that black men and women bear the weight of race in America can make us allies sometimes, competitors at other times. We know about low marriage rates and single motherhood, but did you know black women also were more likely to get subprime loans? Every year, the National Urban League publishes a report called The State of Black America. This year's is called In the Black Woman's Voice. It includes essays by some of the most influential black women in America, including Julianne Malveaux. Julianne Malveaux is also our regular economics contributor and the president of Bennett College. Great to have you with us again.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Farai.
So you wrote this essay for the State of Black America, and you talk about something that you call the third burden for African-American women. What is the third burden?
You know, there's been so much commentary this year about race and gender. Does race trump gender? And I think that there's a nuance that we miss, which is that African-American women are connected to African-American men, so that when African-American men are unfairly treated, it gives a burden to African-American women. The best example I can give is the fact that 1 million more black women work than black men. Now, there are those who would say, oh, gee, this means that African-American women are more advantaged. But I would look at it as saying that African-American women have the burden of having to take on more economic slack in our community.
How do you think that affects, and then I want to move back into some more strictly economic topics, but how do you think that affects dynamics on an interpersonal level between black men and women sometimes?
Well, in my essay in The State of Black America, I attempted to deal with, although I don't think adequately, how the backlash of resentment of rapper types comes from perceiving that African-American women are doing better. After all, if you're sharing a community and you see some sub-constituency being better off, there's a likelihood of anger and resentment. And I think we've seen that. I think all of the rap music with the, not all of it, but the ones that show black women as gold diggers, in unflattering ways are a result of a sort of a backlash saying, you're doing better than me, why are you sweating me?
So what else really pinged your mind when you were looking at the results of this annual survey? I mean, what popped out at you?
Well, you know, Maudine Cooper's essay is just such a brilliant essay when it talks about the way that social services ignores so many African-American women. I think also Alexis Herman's essay, You Take From the Bottom to the Top, that looks at corporate women, is important. For me, it was important to look at black women in our roundest way, in the most phenomenal manifestation of us, which is to look at all of us and to look at this third burden, which I think is so important. I think that, in this year, you've got Barack Obama and Hillary Rodham Clinton and people sort of jockeying, is it race, is it gender? And I would suggest that we can't ever, as African-American women, divide ourselves. In other words, you don't get up in the morning and say, oh, gee, this is going to be my black day.
Right.
And tomorrow's going to be my female day.
Right.
We are all of that, and it's intertwined, and I want us to celebrate our intertwining.
Do you think that economists need to dig in deeper into how these intersections of race and gender play out in the workplace? I mean, do you think this is something, obviously there are plenty of people who work on it, including you, but does it get enough attention, and is there enough impetus to really put into play some of the learning that's happened?
I think we have a lot more work to do when we look at race and gender and African-American women in the economy. I do think that the concept of the third burden, which speaks to any number of our economic manifestations, is a useful one. Of course, that's self-serving to say, but I would say that anyway. But I also think that we need to look at, as we look at unemployment rates, we look at wealth. One of the pieces in the book that I think is really great is one from Andrea Harris, who talks about the fact that African-American women are more likely than any other group to get subprime loans. Why is that? Part of it is a function of the burden that we feel in providing for our families. And so I think that economists could do a lot more, but so could many others, in looking at what it means to be seen as gendered, but to operate as raced. In other words, your son, your cousin, your brother is someone who's collided with the system. Gender doesn't help you there.
There's something else that has gone on with this report, something called the Opportunity Compact, and it talks about four cornerstones of values of the American dream: the opportunity to thrive, the opportunity to earn, the opportunity to own, and the opportunity to prosper. What do those big concepts mean to you?
You know, the Urban League has been really pivotal, Parai, in attempting to put some data around what it means to be American and then African and American in a society that does not affirm you. And so when you talk about thriving, you're talking about living lives free of poverty. You talk about earning, you're talking about equal pay. When you're talking about owning, the whole home ownership, mortgage issue leaps up. You talk about prospering, it's a whole issue of how you get to play in an economy that may be hostile to you. And so what the league has done over the past several years since Marc Morial has been president is attempted to put some numbers around this to say, what does this mean? And what you really see is us treading water and really not improving. There is some improvement in some of the indices, but by and large, you're looking at a level or a flat field for African-American people. I don't find that to be alarming. I find it to be disturbing. But the fact is that improving the racial position has not been a priority for anyone in public policy. And so when we see the result in terms of a very complex index that uses any number of 20 or 30 various kind of indices, you know, you see economics flat. You see health flat. You see that there is a flatness to the way that African American people have moved through the economy in the last year or so.
Now, when you think about what's going on with all of these different aspects, one of the biggest issues really facing the community at this point is housing. And there's a recommendation to adopt a home buyer's bill of rights. What's that bill of rights? What would it do?
It would make sure that people had full information about the kind of things they were getting into. Farai, this last 5 years has been catastrophic for working class people, for African American people, and for others who've attempted to buy. What they found is that predators have come after them and said, oh, you can get a 2% loan. Well, here's the question. How long can you get the 2% loan? We've had our elders, grandmothers and fathers, who need to get their steps fixed. Cost them a grand, $2,000 maybe. But somehow they've got into some loan that they're encumbered for $40,000. You've got people who are involved in loans where they're just buying food, where people are saying, you can buy a freezer full of food, and the next thing you know, their house is on the market. And so the home buyer's bill of rights would really ask lenders to give people more information than they have now. And there are many of us who are very sophisticated, who know how to negotiate this, and probably half of all African-American people and Latinos are basically potential victims.
Now, last week, home equity fell to a record low. The average homeowner's equity dropped to below 50% for the first time since World War II, and the equity being, you know, the amount of it you actually own as opposed to what the bank owns or someone else owns. What does it really mean that people are living in places that you know, we say we own, but we may not actually have that much in them?
Again, it's a sense of economic vulnerability, the sense that you went out there and bought a home and then you refinanced because someone came after you and said, oh, come on, I've got a great deal for you, and then refinance again. People have been living on their home equity, but those chickens will come home to roost, and they are with this new report. What they suggest is that people don't have as much as they think they do. They're more vulnerable than they think they are. Banks and others are going to be forced to make certain kinds of agreements with people who borrowed from them. And what I'm most concerned about is that no race, no gender, no filters come in to separate people of color and women from their property.
On a broader level, there's a report in the Wall Street Journal that the FBI is starting an investigation into the mortgage lender Countrywide for securities fraud. Is this kind of top-level action going to help people who are struggling at this moment in time?
You know, the FBI investigation is too little, too late, and too alarmist. Countrywide didn't break any rules that anyone else did, as far as I'm concerned. I haven't seen anything that suggests that the FBI should be involved. Here's what needs to be an issue. How do we provide mortgage loans? If we'd suggest that home ownership is the American dream, then who gets to have a dream and who has a nightmare? But for the FBI to come in now to look at countrywide as opposed to a variety of others seems to me to be a face-saving game on the part of the Bush administration to make sure that they essentially say, we're not going to put up with this. Now, let me be clear and in full disclosure, my mortgage is a countrywide mortgage. And I just need to say that because I could be accused of favoring countrywide, which I don't. But I do think that this FBI involvement is amusing. What needs to happen is that if the FBI is investigating, they need to be investigating an industry and not a particular lender.
Briefly, do you think that there will be some widespread look at the industry? Will the whole industry be changed?
I think that this is time for the industry to be changed, and I think that we're going to see that. There are so many questions that are being raised about what we do about housing, about how much of this is speculation, about how people are being pushed into loans. You know, you've got people who are blaming black people and blaming poor people and saying, well, these people could never have afforded loans anyway. But if they couldn't have afforded them, why did you give them to them? So we have to look at culpability all around. And I think that this is a climate where culpability is going to be examined fully. And I expect that every number of lenders from Merrill Lynch to Countrywide to Citicorp to others, and there are a dozen or so we could look at,
We're going to have to end it there. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Farai. You always cut me off when I'm rolling.
I know. It's just time. Julianne Malveaux, economist and president of Bennett College, joined us from WFDD in Greensboro, North Carolina. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. An outspoken Obama advisor steps down after calling Clinton a monster. A historically black university hangs on to a major art collection worth millions of dollars, and how pop culture is shaping national elections. We'll tackle it all on our bloggers roundtable, and joining me now to wrap about the headlines is Kim Platt. Kim blogs at AskThisBlackWoman.com. Also, the media assassin Harry Allen, who blogs at HarryAllen.info, and Robert Redding, who publishes the Redding News Review.com. Hey, folks.
Hello.
Hi. Hi, Bri.
So last week, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Samantha Power stepped down as Barack Obama's foreign policy advisor. She gave this interview to the Scottish newspaper, The Scotsman. She referred to Hillary Clinton as, quote, a monster. Now, Power made the comment off the record, but the reporter says it was on the record and decided to publish it anyway. Power apologized to Obama. Obama condemned the comment. Power resigned. A lot of attention to this whole thing. Robert, you've been watching this race very closely. I want to ask you not just about this case, but about advisors in general. What role do unpaid advisors, and Power was one of those unpaid advisors, play in whispering in the candidate's ear? And I don't mean that in a negative way. Someone has to whisper in their ear on all these big issues. What role do they actually play? They're not official employees of the campaign.
Well, they do play a role because they're affiliated with the campaign. Having worked in the campaign, I used to work for Michael Brown, the son of Ron Brown, Commerce Secretary under Clinton, and as his communications director. And anyone that's affiliated with the campaign is definitely a part of the candidate and his team and his philosophy. So you have to be very careful, very measured with that. So with this particular instance, I think what we're seeing is an appropriate move by Ms. Powers at this point to make sure that she doesn't damage Barack Obama. The reason why this is not a big issue, and this whole ethics in journalism, because that's what is involved here, I think, first of all, the reason why it's not a big issue is because she made the comment, and a lot of people agree with that comment. But besides that point, it's just negative. It's not something that he wants. But the ethics issue comes where, as a reporter, having worked at various newspapers, she said it after the fact. Now, that's off the record after she made the comment. That's not the way it works. You say something's off the record, you get the approval, and then you say it. But typically, you should never go off the record with the reporter.
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of it is also that people, there's all these protocols around what is on and what is off the record.
Right.
But in general, if you don't want it published, it's better not to say it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Kim, One of the many articles written about this pointed out that there's a difference between what you want to convey on a level of personal passion and what you can say in the world of politics. Was this just a case of her confusing those two roles?
I think that in general, this election is a very emotional one. And it seems to me that she, yes, she spoke out. She was emotional. And it was an outburst that shouldn't have happened. And she should have used more restraint.
But I think as well that this particular person is very passionate and very direct. And she has a history of that, of dealing with very harsh issues in a very straightforward way. And I think that I don't think it's out of line for her as a person, as an intellect and as a speaker, although clearly it was out of line because it's not the position of the Obama campaign.
Tell me more about that. When you say that it wasn't out of line for her, do you mean that basically this certainly fit in with her personal philosophy? It was just something she shouldn't have said, or?
Well, what I mean is that as I've observed her in the short time I've been able to observe her, Samantha Power she's the author of the book A Problem from Hell, which was amazing text on genocide, the history of genocide, and the problem of genocide. And I think that I think first of all that as a personality, that she is very direct and forthcoming and not one to mince words. And I think that that certainly served her dealing with a subject that, even in her own words, often no one wanted to hear about, no one wanted to talk about. And I think she brings a lot of that to anything she does. But I think that it's a knife that cuts both ways. And in a political campaign, you have to be a bit more gentle. You have to strike more decisively when you choose to strike. You can't just have it going. And I think in this case, she just had it going. It wasn't the Obama style, so to speak.
Let me throw in something else. The Obama camp also uses Susan Rice as a foreign policy advisor. She recently was on MSNBC discussing Hillary Clinton's 3 a.m. red phone ad, a controversial ad about who's ready in times of trouble. TV host Tucker Carlson asked Susan Rice if the Illinois senator has ever made these tough crisis moment decisions. Here's Rice's response.
He hasn't, and he hasn't claimed that he's been in a position to have to answer the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning in a crisis situation. That's the difference between the two of them. Hillary Clinton hasn't had to answer the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning, and yet she attacked Barack Obama for not being ready. They're both not ready to have that 3 a.m. phone call.
Is that kind of not really the perfect thing you should say about your candidate? I mean, Robert, that's kind of a
wow.
It's like the double-edged sword situation.
Yeah, you don't want that kind of thing being said about your own candidate. It's one thing to say that about someone else that you're running against, but is anybody ever ready to be president? She's being honest. I understand what she's saying, but at the same time, as again, I step back into that communication director role. You don't want that kind of stuff out there. And, you know, this kind of goes back to the larger issue. People continue to forget that, and, you know, I'm an independent, but Barack Obama has had a lot of experience at the state level in the state legislature. I mean, again, you're talking about someone who was the commander-in-chief's wife. Let's put this in perspective. They had just about the same amount of time in the Senate, but he has a lot of legislative experience, and that counts for something. That's one of the things that Michael Dukakis was talking about. So, and him himself having a lot of experience in the legislature, et cetera. So.
Before we wrap this up, in general, it sounds like advisors really only get a lot of play if they've done something that doesn't really fall into the this was great column. It's only when they get in trouble that we hear about them. Kim, does that seem right to you?
It doesn't really seem right to me. I think that, you know, some of the policy decisions that a candidate makes or some of the great things that have come out of their campaign should be credited to the advisors that have been working with them. But again, you know, the bad publicity gets the attention. And that's, pretty typical but troubling.
I want to move on to Fisk University. That college, a historically black college, boasts some stellar alums, including W.E.B. Du Bois and Nikki Giovanni, but the Nashville school is also strapped for cash. They were trying to sell valuable works by American painter Georgia O'Keeffe. That collection was estimated at more than $100 million, but a Nashville judge squashed the sales plan. Fisk is officially forbidden from selling any of the pieces. Harry, part of the deal that O'Keeffe made with Fisk when she donated the collection was that Fisk wouldn't sell the pieces and the work would remain on display. I'll talk about the display issue in a minute, but if the work now belongs to Fisk, and if Fisk really needs the money, why shouldn't the agreement with O'Keeffe be reevaluated? Should it be reevaluated at any point?
Well, that's a really good question. I have a colleague, a good colleague by the name of Ray Winbush, who is now at Morgan State operating their Center for Black Studies there, but he used to be at Fisk running the Race Relations Institute, and we were talking about this subject, and he calls the deal that Charles Johnson, who was president in the 40s when the donation was made, a deal with the devil. He compares it to someone being given a brand new Rolls Royce on the condition that they could never drive it, would have to keep it in a warm garage, wash it once a month, wax it four times a year, and keep it insured. And it's a wonderful car. It's one of the most, you know, incredible marks ever made, but you can't do anything with it, and eventually starts to drain on you. And his position is that when O'Keeffe made this deal, it was really almost like what she was trying to do was irritate the New York art world, kind of like saying, I have the Stieglitz collection. I can do whatever I want with it. In fact, I'm going to give it to these black people just so you guys won't have it, just to show you what I can do. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, it's great to have, you know, one of the most valuable collections of the 20th century. But on the other hand, it's become I wouldn't say an albatross, but it's certainly become a hard thing for them to manage. And when I was speaking with Ray, he said that he felt that in the 60s or 70s, when Fisk was a bit more secure financially, they should have gone to court and said that the initial deal was made under racial duress and used that as a way of getting out of this or renegotiating the terms of the agreement.
Kim, when you hear Harry outlining all of these different stipulations and the backstory of it, do you expect that at any point Fisk could go back to the table and ask for a renegotiation, or by this all playing out in court at this point, is it pretty much a done deal?
I think they should absolutely go back to court. And I was under the impression that the gift was made in two segments. And the first segment by Arthur Stieglitz was under the condition that they could never sell it. And then the second set of gifts by Georgia O'Keeffe didn't have that same stipulation. And I'm sure if they parse it apart and are in perhaps a less desperate situation, they'll have more power in court or the ability to negotiate that. But it's just, to me, it's just so troubling that this collection has become a burden for Fisk. And what if, you know, in 100 years, Fisk no longer exists? What happens to the collection? It doesn't really...
Well, Santa Fe Museum gets it.
Yeah, there's definitely...
So it's just a matter of, you know, keeping it on display and having this, you know, historic black college and the students look at this artwork instead of having it be collateral or something, the ability to get money or make money from it.
But, you know, it's interesting. I think, not to interrupt you, Kim, I think that this is kind of like a metaphor for much of the state of black America, like incredible, precious gifts, but insufficient infrastructure to manage them. And then those things often sometimes work against us or don't work in our favor or work for other people.
Robert, when you listen to this case, do you think that it resonates with the larger issues of how historically black colleges and universities, despite having great alums, despite having a lot of support, just don't have a lot of the time these fundamental... I mean, if you think about schools like Harvard and Yale and plenty of other schools, there are these multi-billion dollar endowments, and things are running pretty thin for a lot of HBCUs. What could turn that around?
They are. And what needs to happen and what we have to be very cognizant of within the black community is that we need to make sure that we give back to the schools that gave so much to us. I think it's a sad day when we have schools like Fisk that are in danger, schools like FAMU that are in danger in financial status. But let me just say one of the things that is important here, race is an issue in terms of this collection, the way it was handed down. But black schools have to realize, because I've covered this extensively as a reporter, with Attorney Melvin Gibbs and the William H. Johnson case of artwork, he's been litigating for some time against people like Fisk, people like Tuskegee, people like the Smithsonian, talking about you have to follow a chain, the appropriate chain of ownership. You cannot just do what you want with this artwork when you get it. And I think there was an element of that with Fisk. They thought they could do this, and reading the agreement, they can't. There are some restrictions here. So they have to follow the letter of the law until they can get the law on their side.
I want to pop in case anyone is just tuning in to us. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We were just hearing from Robert Redding, who publishes the RedingNewsReview.com. Also, we've got the media assassin Harry Allen, who blogs at HarryAllen.info, and Kim Platt, who blogs at AskThisBlackWoman.com. So I will ask this black woman about pop culture and politics. You know, the pundits and the pollsters get their glory during the campaign season. So do the comedy shows, and SNL, Saturday Night Live, has taken on Clinton and Obama. A couple of weekends ago, the New York senator popped on to the Saturday Night Live set, and here she is opposite SNL's Amy Poehler, who plays Clinton on the show.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you for coming. I love your outfit.
Well, I love your outfit.
Why, thank you.
Do you want the earrings back? Do I really laugh like that?
So
So it was all fun and giggles, but some people feel that SNL has actually been favoring Clinton. They've done a sketch that we talked about on the show on a previous day that basically implies that Obama has been getting a free pass from the press. What do you think, Kim? Do you think that this is a situation where SNL or other outlets could actually influence the election?
I think they can influence, because the American public is... can be influenced. And I think, you know, you said SNL is taking on Barack and Hillary. I think they're actually just taking on Barack. And this past Saturday, there was the skit where, you know, the Barack Obama has a 3 a.m. phone call, and he actually calls Hillary Clinton and asks for advice. So I think they've really come out and declared Hillary as their candidate of choice without, you know, so much as saying they are endorsing her. And they're doing it with humor, and humor is very powerful, and I think people can be influenced.
Harry, does that sound as if it's SNL has chosen sides?
I don't really think so. I think Hillary's the bigger target. I think that she's bigger and easier in a way to make fun of. And I have to admit, the thing that I found most striking while watching the sketch that you just played audio from, and I also had this reaction when I was watching her appearance on Jon Stewart's show, was for the moment I was watching her, I actually found myself liking her. Like, I just found myself, like, connecting to her. And this must have been, I guess, the way many white women felt when they saw her cry. That I actually found myself liking her just for the moment I saw her there with her timing, her humor. She seemed very natural and at ease, you know, in a way that she doesn't come off when she's, you know, I guess, spouting policy.
Robert, is there any place else that you turn? For example, The Daily Show is a news comedy hybrid. What other places do you think are really influential right now? Just a couple of them.
In terms of the mosh pit?
Yep.
Well, of course, Colbert Report. It's definitely one of the shows that's at the top of the list. So outside of that, I really don't know of many other shows, because I don't even watch those. You know, for political hard edge stuff, that's why I thank God for NPR. because
And also YouTube,
right? And the mosh pit, yeah. I think they do follow SNL, and they think that this is where it's all originating from. But my sources, like I said, in Washington D.C., tell me that one of the reasons why we see the media picking sides and taking sides is not because SNL ran this skit and is weighing in on this election. It's because these media organizations really are hurting and are short on change to cover this race.
And Robert, can you confirm
Yes.
we did not ask you for that endorsement of our services?
That's right.
All right. On that note, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Farai.
We've been talking with Robert Redding, who publishes the RedingNewsReview.com. He was on the line from Radio People Studios in Monroe, Louisiana. Also, Kim Platt, who blogs at AskThisBlackWoman.com, and writer Harry Allen, who blogs at HarryAllen.info. They both joined me from our NPR studios in New York. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. A month ago, Leland Melvin got his first taste of space. He helped crew the shuttle Atlantis on its 13-day mission to the International Space Station. Melvin is one of only a handful of African Americans to make it through astronaut training and into the skies. But he didn't plan on a NASA career. After college, he was drafted by the NFL to play wide receiver for the Detroit Lions. I spoke with Melvin about the Atlantis mission and what it feels like to finally achieve liftoff.
You know, you hear the 3, 2, 1, the main engine's light, the solid rocket booster's light, and you know when they light you're heading off the planet. And you feel the rumble, the vibrations, and we have mirrors on our sleeve that we look out of the overhead window. And we can see the Earth, you know, leaving you at a very, very rapid pace. The engines, they throttle down to 74%. When they come back up to 104%, it feels like someone has you in a slingshot, propelling you off to the cosmos. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the most amazing things, not only the feelings, but working together as a team, doing all the things that we've done in training to ensure the safe launch. And I relate a lot of that to, you know, some of the football training where you're on a highly functioning team and, you know, there are things that happen in a very short period of time that give you the sense of satisfaction when you win. And it's the same thing here. And I try to tell kids, you know, if you can play sports, if you can do all these things, you can be an astronaut because it's very similar. The training is similar. It's just that you have to learn something different.
When you achieved an exit from the Earth's atmosphere and started floating around, what's that like?
Well, you know, all my friends and colleagues who have done it before, they tell you about it and the sensation and the feelings. But until you push off of a structure and start floating, you know, unhindered by the gravitational pull of the Earth, you twist, you tumble, you turn, you try to keep from going out of control, which is so easy to do, and it's so freeing.
Now, the Atlantis had some delays, and there was testing of an element of the fuel sensor system. NASA has had some technical problems in the past. Were you ever concerned that the craft you were going up in was not going to be ready for the task?
You know, obviously, things with Challenger and Columbia and things have happened. And, you know, we have such a dedicated team on the ground that focuses, you know, especially on the details, but ensures that we are flying safely. And that's one of our tenets at NASA. Safety is job one. And I just have a lot of faith in the people here. And I have, you know, faith in general that things will work out. And, you know, I never paused once. I was ready to go as soon as they said, hey, it is clear to fly.
Ronald McNair was one of the astronauts who died in the space shuttle disaster. And he's someone who, his name is on scholarships, and he's someone who is revered as a hero. How many African-American astronauts are there now besides yourself? I mean, I'm sure that when you go out and speak to kids, when you go out and speak to anyone, people are like, wow, this is amazing. How is the astronaut corps in terms of diversity?
We have currently, and by the way, I actually flew a picture of Ronald McNair, and I brought a picture back for his wife, Cheryl, who lives in the neighborhood. And he has given us so much inspiration, and the other, you know, fallen heroes like Michael Anderson have given the African-Americans in the Corps inspiration to ensure that we bring more people into the Corps. Currently, we have five of us in the Corps right now, and we are in a recruitment campaign right now to bring more qualified people into the astronaut corps. And diversity is, you know, one of the very important things that we're looking for in people that can do the job.
So when you go and talk to kids, I mean, you know, things always change over time. I remember that show, I think it was called Big Blue Marble, and, mm-hmm. you know, and really seeing space as this exciting thing when I was a kid. And now I wonder if kids are more into, well, I want to be the next Jay-Z or I want to be the next Tyra Banks. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Right.
But when you go out and talk to kids, do they have any aspirations? Do you ever meet kids who say, I want to be an astronaut too?
Well, I do, and I do meet the Jay-Z and the Tyra wannabes also, and I tell them, hey, go for your dreams, but have a fallback plan. And that fall, you know, for me, that fallback plan was education. And I see kids all the time that you show them the slides of what it's like to be in space, and you know, this whole different experience. It's something that I never grew up with, and a lot of these kids have never seen. And plus, they've never really seen people like myself flying in space, so that's a new one for them. And once you show them that, you know, I was in algebra class like you were in eighth grade, and I did the same things that you did, you know, it's nothing magic about Leland Melvin. Part of it is the education of letting them see that there is, you know, this dedication and this working hard, this work ethic. And if they have that work ethic and do apply themselves, they can do it also.
Why is space important? Not just for you, not just for people who are interested in space exploration, not just for people who may look at the practical applications down the line, but for the country.
Well, I think of not just for the country, I think of for the world. I mean, I was floating through the space station and I saw, you know, a German astronaut working in the Columbus module. I saw a French astronaut working. I saw an African-American astronaut working. And, you know, when you look down on the Earth and you see all of these places where there's turmoil, where there's war and things going on, but we have harmony in space where people are working together for a greater cause, even without all the scientific research and things that are developed, it's a way to show how our world can work together in peace and harmony.
Do you have any concerns that the space shuttle program will be closed out and nothing else will come to replace it? Or do you think that there is going to be either a continuation of the program or a transition into, you know, future designs? How do you see that playing out?
The shuttle is supposed to retire in 2010. As a civilization, you know, once we stop exploring, that's when we will falter. So I think space exploration has to continue for our society, for our world, for the people and humankind.
Leland, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was NASA astronaut Leland Melvin. He just returned from a 13-day mission to the International Space Station on the Space Shuttle Atlantis. If Motown owned the 60s, you might say the 70s belonged to Philly International Records. Super producers Kenneth Gamble and Leon Huff defined the sound of Philadelphia for the world. Now, after having racked up just about every major award there is, including 175 gold and platinum records, the duo is finally being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We sat down to talk about the arc of their amazing careers, the performers they introduced to the world, and those classic tunes like Backstabbers, the song that launched the legendary OJs.
What they do, they smile in your face.
What they doing, smiling. Mm-hmm. You know, so
yeah.
We thought that was a great message.
Yeah, I thought that was a tremendous hook when I first heard it. I said, boy, what they doing? I mean, that was really the hook to me.
We went in and cut the track. Well, first we showed it to the OJs, which they didn't like it when they first heard it. So Gamble convinced them that just it's experiment. Let's go into the studio and see how it comes out. And that's when it all started to happen for the OJs.
What's tight in their fists, aiming straight at your back, and I don't think they'll miss what they do.
So how did each of you get interested in music? I mean, as children, I'm sure that you must have been interested. You wouldn't have been so successful if you hadn't started young. So how did you, Leon,
I started as a musician first, as a piano player, because my mother played piano. And that's how the piano got into the house. So I guess I must have became curious of that big thing sitting in the living room. And I look at it like, a child would see something and stick his hand up on those black and white things and hear them sounds come out of it. And I guess I must have gravitated toward that, became obsessed with it. And nobody never really taught me. I was playing music, but I didn't know the name of the chords. You know, later on I did, you know, but... That's how I developed an ear, for, you know, for popular music.
What about you, Kenneth?
I used to write poetry at a young age. And so I guess I always had, like, a knack for writing. South Philly, where I grew up at, always was people standing on the corners. And eventually it would turn out to be some kind of a singing group where you start singing. And I always would come up with a song, you know. It was just a great time to be growing up for music and, you know, lyrics. I write lyrics.
But how did you actually meet up? How did you connect and not just connect, but say, we're going to make a business out of this?
Well, we wasn't formally introduced. We just happened to work in a music building called the Schubert Theater in Philadelphia, and we worked on different floors. So we just happened to meet in the elevator this particular day, and we introduced ourselves, and Ben Gamble came over my house one weekend.
I think the magic started when I met Huff.
Yeah! First sitting, we must have wrote about 6 or 7 songs. Yeah!
What does it take to identify talent? I think about, you know, the fact that there's so many reality shows now that look for talent. How do you identify talent?
Well, most of the time, we tried to find a voice that was unique and something that someone could identify and say, wow, that's Teddy Pendergrass, or that's Eddie of the OGs, or that Patti LaBelle, you know, or Aretha Franklin, or whatever. You know, when you hear it on the radio, you say, wow, that's so-and-so. And I think that's what we look for. We look for the uniqueness in the artist. And
as performers.
Yeah, performers. Because you got to be able, once you get a hit record, then when you do your show, it makes it easier.
Want to hear a little bit of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, the song, If You Don't Know Me By Now.
Just get yourself together.
That featured Teddy Pendergrass when he was part of an ensemble. How did you guys start working with him?
You know, we knew Hal Melvin for many years. Hal had a smooth voice himself, but we always thought that he needed a real lead singer. And so Huff was working one day with Teddy, and I think Teddy was the drummer, Huff, or something like that?
He was the drummer. I heard this big booming voice in the background, you know, that just stood out. You know, so I said, God, I'm on this guy in the background can really sing. Listen to the sound of his voice, you know. After Teddy made his entrance as a lead singer, I mean, he just roared all over the place, you know, his feeling, I mean, intensity, you know, that's what I felt. And he just did it naturally. His voice just stood out. We just took on a real big interest in Teddy's voice.
You really came to the prominence of your careers in the mid-70s. And music constantly changes. So you had disco, you had funk. How did you relate to these other sounds coming into vogue?
Well, I think we just did what we could do. We didn't try to compete. Some people say that, you know, some of our music was the beginning of disco, you know. We concentrated on songs. Songs and great musicians and great arrangements. And so we didn't try to really follow any trends or whatever. I think that's the best part of it, that we created our own sound out of the whole thing.
Yeah, what's that song, Gamble? Do it any way you want it by the people's choice.
Right. Mm.
I think that was one of the earlier records that was mixed by
Tom Moulton. Yeah, Tom Moulton.
Which
the disco guy.
Prominent mixer during those days. And he just wanted to mix that song, and it just took on a different life, you know.
Did you ever worry, okay, this other stuff is going to cut into our market share, we're not going to be as relevant, people are going to forget about us? Did you ever, I mean, have moments of insecurity about the direction you were taking?
We always had the mindset of writing music that would stand the test of time. You know, we just didn't settle with just a hit. You know, a hit can last for a few weeks. You know, and that's it. You know, but we wanted to write songs that would go into the standard category. You know, classic music. You know, that would be around 20, 30, 40 years. You know, that was our mindset. You know.
Calling you, I'm touching. spoke with the music critic Stephen Ivory, and he said that he believes that in some ways the Philly sound got so big that it permeated everything, and it became no longer exclusive to what you two were doing. First of all, do you agree? And secondly, do you feel that that's a positive or a negative, that so many people have kind of taken bits and pieces of what you do and incorporated it into what they do?
You know, when you're hot, people are going to gravitate towards what you're doing. You know, people started using our studios. You know, Stevie Wonder come in.
David Bowie, you know. Elton John. Elton John. Came from everywhere, all over the world.
So, you know, like you're saying, we were so hot. They said, well, let us go down in Philly, see if we can get some of that, see if it can rub off on us, you know. So we always felt good about that, you know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've gotten so many honors. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is huge. But if you were to take one of your songs and put it in a time capsule, tell me what one song of yours you would pick.
So I would say For the Love of Money. The OJs. You know, that was a very, very intense session. We was producing that.
I think I would pick Love Train. I pick
People
Love
All
Train.
Over the
People
world.
All, yeah, I picked that one. Yeah, that was a good one.
Well, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed the conversation, and may the music keep on flowing. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The legendary songwriting and production team of Kenneth Gamble and Leon Huff. Today, the two are being honored with a place in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. To watch an excerpt of the interview you just heard, go to our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.